the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest today is Drew Collins, and the subject is chelation therapy, its advantages in being able to clean out arteries that are partially clogged and promote arterial health. You know, one of the aspects of today's market is that retirees are facing the lowest interest rates in a 5,000-year history. The defined benefit pension plans are gone. For most retirees, it amounts to whatever they saved and what they can gain on investments. Cash pays nothing. And if you want safe returns from bonds, well, you're lucky to get 2 or 3%. So what this does is it makes Social Security one of the main sources of dependable income in a low interest rate environment and a volatile financial market. However, many retirees are not maximizing their benefits, taking money early, and foregoing larger payouts for themselves and their surviving spouses. So what we want to cover on today's program are strategies that can help you maximize your Social Security benefits for yourself and for your surviving spouse.
And what's rather interesting, John, and you and I have talked about this on the program in the past, but according to the Social Security Administration, the vast majority of recipients claim their benefits without checking their options. And nearly 80% of Americans receiving Social Security have taken their Social Security at the beginning age of 62. So they take those benefits early and they miss out on the opportunities to maximize those benefits over their lifetime. So today we're going to cover five strategies. And in subsequent shows, by the way, we're going to cover maximizing benefits for women, including widows and single women, women that have gone through divorces. But there's also a whole category we're going to cover, but that's going to be a show on its own. But before I do, I want to point out that as we talk about these strategies for maximizing Social Security, many of them are going to be delaying, switching strategies. A lot of this depends on a couple of things. One, your health and life expectancy. I mean, if you are in poor health, don't have a history of longevity in the family, you may have no choice but to take your benefits early. And also, if you're not in a financial situation where you can either work until full retirement age or postpone taking Social Security benefits. So if you need income or in need of income because you don't have any other source of income, then that may not apply. So just, John, I wanted to put those two caveats out there depending on health and financial needs as we get into these maximizing strategies.
Okay, well, before we begin, perhaps what we should do for listeners is to do a refresher on some of the basics here that we're going to be framing.
Well, let's talk about something that we refer to on the program as FRA, which is full retirement age. If you were born after 43, if you're in that age group between 43, 54, you're in the front end of the baby boomer market, your full retirement age is 66. Then it goes up 2 months each year after 1960. And after 1960, your full retirement age is 67. So just want to talk about when we're talking about maximizing these strategies, they're taking advantage of the full retirement age, whether it's file and suspend, file and restrict, all of these assume a full retirement age. So that's basically it. Depending on when you're born, your full retirement age is going to be either 66 or 67. Another simple way to look at these choices is you basically have three choices when it comes to Social Security. You can take it as soon as you can, which is age 62. You can wait till your full retirement age, in this case being 66 or age 67. And the third choice is delay your benefits to age 70. Now, ignoring investment returns and just looking at the cumulative benefits over your life expectancy, actuarially speaking, a person who lives their life expectancy would expect to receive the same amount of benefits theoretically, regardless of the choices they make. But life, as we all know, is full of surprises, just as the returns are from investments. Now, let me just throw some numbers out there for you. If you are a male, age 62, your life expectancy is 21.8 years, or roughly 83.8. If you are a male, age 66, your life expectancy is 84.8 years, or almost 19 years. And at age 70, your life expectancy is 16 years, or age 86. This is important because both male and female, men and women, are living longer today. On the female side, it gets better. At age 62, life expectancy is 24 years, 86.3 years, about a 3-year difference between men. At age 66, life expectancy is 21, age 87, and then at age 70, it's almost 18 years, and it's 87.9 years. So it's very important when we're talking about these strategies is taking a look at your health and the normal life expectancy for both you and your spouse.
And since we're talking about maximizing benefits for a married couple, it's very, very important to stress this, that this decision should be made together, because the age at which you apply for benefits may affect the amount your surviving spouse will receive. So if we have a married couple, how does this couple maximize their benefits?
You know, really, a top goal for couples, John, is to boost the benefit for the surviving spouse, who will get 100% of the higher Social Security benefit of either the higher spouse's wage, like let's say most of the time it's the husband who earned the most, or her benefits, whichever is better. So when the first spouse passes away, what you want to do is take advantage of the survivor benefits beyond full retirement age. Now, a rule of thumb, and this is just a rule of thumb for most married couples, if just one spouse is expected to live well beyond age 80, the couple's cumulative lifetime benefits will usually be highest if the higher earner delays claiming their benefits till age 70. So let's say in most cases, this is the husband. If the husband does something, one of the strategies we'll be talking about, file and suspend, allowing his Social Security to accumulate and grow to age 70, that will end up creating more cumulative benefits for both himself and that of his wife. Most of the things that we're going to be talking about here are strategies called switching, where one spouse can file for a limited benefit and then later switch to a larger benefit. And there are basically five strategies we're going to be talking about. One is called the reset, redo strategy. Two is suspending benefits strategy. Three is file and suspend, one of my favorites. Four is restricted application. And five is a combination. So there's five various ways, depending on what your circumstances are, how much you have in other pensions, what your lifestyle needs are, your health, and obviously, if you have other things like a large IRA rollover. So we're going to discuss here five strategies in terms of how you can maximize your benefits. And believe it or not, maximizing your benefits can add up literally to hundreds of thousands of dollars during your lifetime.
Well, the first one you mentioned was the reset or redo strategy. So let's start with that. You know, it's hard to believe that you get a chance to reset your benefits, because a lot of the thinking was that once you finally decided on what you were doing, you didn't have a chance to redo it. But here you can actually reset some.
Yeah, this one is a strategy that allows somebody that's already receiving Social Security to boost their income by repaying the benefits received in earlier years. Say, for example, that you decide, you know, everybody gets their benefits at age 62. You're age 62, assuming you're retired and not working. That's a whole nother story in terms of losing your benefits. But let's just say that you retire at age 62. The standard thing is, yeah, I'm going to get my Social Security benefits. Later on, you find, maybe listening to this show or you get other information, you find out, maybe that wasn't the best choice. There are other options for me. Well, the Social Security Department is going to let you basically pay them back. What you would have to do is fill out a form SSA 521. Once you file this form, your benefits stop immediately. And if your spouse is getting a spousal benefit, her benefits stop too. Then what will happen is Social Security will send you a bill notifying you how much you need to repay them back. Now, John, back in the old days, let's say you were age 62, you started your benefits, and you went on for 3 years, and you said, oh my goodness, that wasn't the best choice. Or you went back to work, whatever it is, you could pay back all 3 years and you would start the clock over again. Well, under the Obama administration in 2010, now that is only applicable if you do that within the first 12 months of receiving your Social Security benefits. And by the way, you can only do this once. So if you did take it out at age 62, basically in the next 12 months, if let's say you're listening to this program and you're learning, but hey, maybe that wasn't the right decision to make for me and my wife, you can now file form SSA 521. And then what you would do is you would pay back, let's say you receive benefits for 12 months, you would simply cut Social Security a check for the 12 months worth of benefits that they sent you. You don't have to pay them any interest. There's no penalty. However, you know, I just thought of this, something if you do pay that back, if you are one of those individuals that makes enough money where you could have up to 50% or 85% of your Social Security included in your income tax, then you're going to want to amend your tax return because you ended up paying them back the money, but you already paid tax on that Social Security benefit. So there's two things involved here. It's not just filing to pay Social Security back for those 12 months you received it or how many months you received it before you basically stopped it. But if it was included as taxable income on your tax return, you're going to want to get to your accountant because you got a tax refund coming.
Now, what about if you regret that decision, but you've received benefits for more than 12 months? Is it too late to do anything?
Now, here's some good news, believe it or not. And that brings me to our next option, which is called suspending benefits. Let's say that, for example, you, in this case, took out your Social Security benefits at age 62. And let's just say that, you know, John started collecting Social Security at age 62. John's full retirement age is 66. Because John's benefits were taken 4 years early, he would have received only 75% of his Social Security benefit versus had he waited to age 66 when he would have got 100% of his benefit. So now what John has found out, maybe he's listening to this program and he goes, maybe that wasn't the best thing for me to do. So what he does is, gosh, I've been receiving these benefits for 4 years. He reaches age 66, which is his full retirement age. What he does is he files and suspends his Social Security at age 66. You can only do this at age 66. And then what happens from age 66 to age 70, John's Social Security benefit would go up 8% a year or increase by 32%. And that will put him back to a level of Social Security had he waited to his full retirement age. So, John, this is another way where the government basically allows you to say, hey, I made a mistake, but here's another way you can correct it. So we just talked about the reset strategy where you pay back within 12 months. And this one is basically the suspending benefits strategy, which you can do at full retirement age. However, if you are on Social Security and receiving Medicare, you are still going to be responsible to pay your Medicare Part B premiums.
All right, let's get into the next option, file and suspend. Just tell me, how can I get any money?
Well, we're talking about the government. Of course, you can get some money. Quite honestly, this is one we use quite often. It's one of my favorite strategies for maximizing benefits, especially for a surviving spouse. What happens, the husband usually files for Social Security because he's probably the main breadwinner. And let's assume he's at full retirement age, 66. Then he suspends, he files and suspends until age 70, in which case his benefits are going to go up 8% a year. At age 70, he would receive 132% of his Social Security benefit. Now, when he files, assuming his wife's age 62, she can get half of her husband's benefit. This also makes it possible for the wife to receive a higher benefit upon the death of her husband. Because think about this. If the husband files at age 66 and suspends, his Social Security payment or benefit is going to go up 8% a year, guaranteed by the government for the next 4 years, or go up 32%. Now, at age 70, you have to take it at age 70. There's no benefit to delaying unless you want to give the government money. At age 70, his benefits can be larger. Assuming that the husband predeceases his wife, that allows the surviving spouse to take her husband's Social Security benefit that is much, much larger. So this leaves a lot more money to the surviving spouse. And I want to give you an example of how this works. And let's just take a hypothetical example. We'll call them Jack and Jill. Both of them are age 62 in the year 2015. Now, Jack's benefit at age 66 for Social Security would be $2,200 a month. And let's assume his wife's benefit at her full retirement is $800. So obviously, Jack was the main breadwinner. He's got the larger Social Security benefit. Now, according to life expectancy tables of Social Security, Jack would be expected to live to age 86. Jill's life expectancy in this case would be closer to 90 years old. They want to determine the optimal time to start taking retirement benefits. If they were both to begin taking benefits at age 62 would be one option. Their cumulative total benefit income would be roughly $1,315,000. Let's call it $1,316,000. That's over both their lifetimes, assuming Jill lives longer, closer to 90, as we talked about in those Social Security mortality ages that we discussed earlier. Now, the second option is they both wait to age 66, in which they both take their full retirement benefit. In this case, instead of $1,316,000, the benefit would be $1,547,000, roughly, folks, $231,000 more income over their lifetime. Now, think about that for a minute. A couple hundred thousand dollars more in Social Security benefits. However, there's another option. Let's say Jill takes her benefit at age 62. Jack files and suspends at age 66. Jill starts her spousal benefit at age 66, and Jack takes his benefit at age 70. Under that scenario, the total lifetime benefits would be roughly about $1,650,000, roughly about $326,000 more than taking it at age 62. So you can start to see here how these different strategies start adding up to hundreds of thousands. And in the last case I mentioned, over $300,000 more in Social Security benefits.
What's really important here is that these examples actually illustrate the major differences when you look at how options can really increase the benefits received. And these tend to be considerable sums of money. So now you can see where knowing the options can really make a significant difference over the lifetime of income benefits received.
Yeah, and it gets even better. You could use, for example, the next strategy, file and suspend, and combine it with file and restrict. So we're going to talk about two strategies here, file and suspend, file and restrict. And under these examples, what happens here? The husband files for Social Security when he reaches full retirement age. In this case, most of us are talking about somebody age 66 here. And then what happens? He suspends. In this illustration, let's just assume, to make this easy, that both husband and wife are the same age, age 66. Now, what happens when the husband files and suspends, the wife can file for one half of her husband's benefits, which is, you know, actually probably larger than her own. So the wife basically files and suspends her Social Security benefits, allowing her benefits to compound to age 70, which means they would be going up 8% a year. In the meantime, she's getting one half of her husband's benefit, which is larger. So at age 70, she now gets 132% of her Social Security benefits. Her husband, who filed and suspends, gets 132% of his benefits. And let's go back to this couple we'll call Jack and Jill. Jack's benefit in this case, he paid into the maximum of Social Security. His benefit is $2,663 a month. Jill's benefit is $1,247 a month. Now, I'm taking this from an actual case study, which we'll discuss later. We advised Jack to file and suspend, and Jill to file and suspend, allowing them to both compound, because they were both the same age, both to compound their Social Security benefits to age 70. Here's what happens. By filing and suspending, Jack's monthly benefit goes from $2,663 to $3,623, roughly almost $1,000 more a month. On the other hand, Jill's monthly benefit goes from roughly $1,247 to $1,697, about a $400 increase. So at age 70, both Jack and Jill would be getting $5,320 a month, or almost $64,000. Let me throw another perspective on that. What would it take in assets today invested in a bond fund paying 3%, the $63,840 a year from Social Security? You would need $2,128,000 of capital to equal that $63,840 guaranteed by Social Security. So you can see, John, a significant difference here. We were doing file and suspend and file and restrict. Because the wife was getting one half, remember, when Jack filed for Social Security, that allowed his wife to be eligible for 50% of his benefits. But he suspends, which means his benefit continues to compound at 8% a year. His wife, being the same age, she files, is called file and restrict, because she's getting her husband's benefit. When she is going to allow hers to compound, it's called file and restrict. So here are two strategies where we're using file and suspend on the husband's part, file and restrict on the wife's part, and it makes up a significant difference, almost $18,000 more a year in Social Security benefits at age 70. That's, you know, almost $1,500 a month. It really starts to become significant.
This really hits home. I mean, it's amazing when you think about that for a moment, because if you look at the interest rate environment we're in today, here your benefit grows by 8% per year for 4 years guaranteed. I mean, that's enough to get one to pause, and reinforces the theme of this program of why you want to have a retirement plan. It literally could make a difference to you of hundreds of thousands of dollars over the life of the retirement, as we've illustrated right here using some real world figures and looking at the Social Security benefit options. Now, what about the last strategy? We call it the combination strategy.
The combination strategy, what you're trying to do here is to maximize benefits. Some of the previous strategies we talked about was really maximizing benefits for a surviving spouse. Under this strategy, we're really trying to maximize benefits for both spouses at three different stages of their life. It involves combining certain elements of both the file and suspend, claim now, and claim more later strategies. And this strategy involves several steps to implement. Step number one, once both reach full retirement age, the higher income earner files and suspends his payments to age 70. What this does is it maximizes survivor benefits for his or her spouse. Step number two, at full retirement age, the lower earning spouse files a restriction application, which means she's going to allow her own benefits to compound at 8% a year, but she's going to get half of her husband's benefit. So it allows her to get a check, but allows her benefits to compound at 8%, the husband's benefits compounding at 8% as well. The third step is at age 70, the lower paying spouse switches to his or her benefit, it's larger. So if the amount that you're receiving from your husband, when you get that at age 66, you're getting that. Now at age 70, you compare what you're getting from your husband's part compared to what your own benefits would be had you allowed them to compound at 8%. So that gives you another decision to take the larger amount. But when you think about it, in this case, at age 70, let's say that your benefit is larger. Let's say that there was only a difference of $400 or $500 between, let's say, your benefit and your spouse's benefit, which is we're going to talk about in a case study here. But you're getting a check And then at age 70, you're both getting 132% of your Social Security benefit. So you not only, both spouses in this case, maximized both their benefits. And so the key assumption here is, once again, the lower earning spouse has this option. So you can look at age 70. If it exceeds 50% of her husband's Social Security benefit, at that point, she switches over to her own benefit.
Okay. Can you give us a few examples which illustrate some of these different strategies?
In this case, let's go back to our example of, let's say, Jack and Jill. In this case, we're going to use Jack has a Social Security benefit of $1,800 and Jill's Social Security benefit is $1,500. Now, you're going to see why I kind of changed this up a little bit, because there's only about a $300 difference between Jack and Jill's Social Security benefit. And you see a lot more of this today because, you know, in the beginning in the 70s, the women went into the workforce. You have a lot of professional women today, PhDs in the business world that are making good money. But anyway, given these circumstances, step one, Jack files and suspends his benefit, allowing it to grow to age 70. His age 70 benefit would go from $1,800 to $2,370 a month. Jill files at age 66, a restricted claim, and then goes for spousal benefits, receiving $900, which is one half of Jack's $1,800 had he taken Social Security at age 66. Now, when Jack reaches age 70, he claims his $2,370 a month Social Security benefit because it no longer goes up by 8%. When Jill reaches age 70, she claims her age 70 benefit, which has grown from $1,500 to $1,980, increasing their combined monthly benefit to $4,350 a month. And so you can see there under this illustration here, when you have not as large of a gap between the husband and wife, you're both better off going with the file and suspend on part of the husband, assuming he has the larger benefit, and the file and restrict on part of the wife. That way you maximize the Social Security benefit during both your lifetimes, as well as maximizing the benefit for the surviving spouse.
Okay, time now to review this week's case study. We always do this every week on the program, and this is a real-world event, meaning it did happen. We simply changed the names of the people to protect their privacy, so let's create some names here this week. Who's on the docket?
I'm just going to call them Jack and Jill Jones. As I mentioned, this was the case that we looked at earlier, and let's add a little bit more color to this case. Jack was a retired technology executive. When he retired, he had about $5.8 million in company stock. Rolling over his 401k plan and profit sharing, he had about $3 million in IRA rollover. He had a home that was paid for roughly about $1.5 million. Now, the two issues that Jack was facing was a large concentration of assets in a single stock, not only his company stock he owned individually, but also some of the stock that was inside his 401k plan. And that tech stock barely paid a dividend. They just recently, in the last couple of years, started paying a dividend. But he was also facing estate taxes, given the size of his estate, and also income taxes. Now, the one thing that he wanted to do, he paid high taxes all his life. He said, you know, I'm retired. I don't want to be stuck paying high taxes the rest of my life. He also didn't want to have a high concentration in a company stock. It was no longer growing the way it once did, let's say 20 years, 30 years ago when he started with the company. What we did is we sold the stock. What we did is we created a laddered bond portfolio after capital gains taxes. He had roughly about $4.5 million after paying his taxes. And we created a tax-free bond portfolio that was producing roughly about $145,000 a year. We also had Jack file and suspend his Social Security benefits. And also we recommended Jill restrict her benefits and then taking half of Jack. So the Joneses also had a potential estate tax problem and an income tax problem. And one of the things I talked to him about, you know, he had a $3 million IRA. And at age 70 and a half, assuming that IRA would continue to grow in the way it was invested, he could have another million, a million and a half. He could have a $4.5 million IRA, at which time he would have to begin taking not only his Social Security distributions for himself, his wife would be taking her Social Security distributions. All of this would be subject to an 85% tax or included in the tax return. Then on top of that, he would be taking mandatory distributions from a significant amount of an IRA that would go up every single year and put them in a permanent tax bracket. So one of the things that we wanted to do is with the tax-free bonds is that would allow him to draw down his IRA. And the plan was basically to take down a couple $100,000 a year out of his IRA, draw it down and get it close to $2 million at age 70. The money would be taxed at a lower tax bracket. And then what we would do is we would be investing in building the municipal bond portfolio. And we wanted to do that because I said, you know, you just have enough assets in that IRA and the size of your estate plus what your Social Security benefits are going to be. You know, it's going to be one heck of a problem to keep you in that 25 to 28% bracket. But if we don't do this, this way, you're going to be in the 36% bracket. And who knows, you live long enough, you can be in the Obama brackets of 39.6, losing your exemptions, losing a lot of other things. So we basically, the plan was to draw down the IRA while we can, while he was in a low tax bracket, setting himself up for age 70, when he was not only going to be looking at almost $60,000 a year in Social Security benefits, of which 85% would be subject to income taxes, and roughly about $100,000 he'd probably have to start taking out of his IRA, which would be 100% taxable. So one of the things that we did on the estate planning side, drawing down the IRA, setting up stretch provisions in the beneficiary to the IRA so it wouldn't be taxed in the year of the death, the final spouse. We also began a gifting program of 529 plans for the grandchildren. So, John, here was not only maximizing Social Security benefits, but also, as many retirees end up facing in their later years, is when you're forced to start taking money out of your IRA at age 70 and a half, all the money that comes out of your IRA is ordinary income, and that would be subject in each year. In fact, I met with a client yesterday, and we were basically shifting part of the portfolio because she's getting at that age now. Her husband passed away, but she has a seven-figure IRA, and now she's in her mid-80s, and the distributions are getting larger and larger and larger, and she's going into a higher tax bracket. So we're shifting some of the portfolio from dividend-paying stocks. We're shifting it over on the tax-free side because, you know, basically her income distributions this year are going to go up by $11,000. And, you know, I told her, I said, next year it could probably be $16,000. So here's something that you want to think long-term planning, that if you do have a large IRA, combining what you're doing with your IRA, also with the strategies that you're pursuing to maximize your Social Security benefits.
Well, emphasizing the importance, first of all, having a plan, but also understanding what your options are in combining your Social Security benefits with other plans you may have. Coming up next on Lifetime Income, Drew Collins, the benefits of chelation therapy in removing junk from your arterioles and thereby preventing cloggages in the future. All of that as Lifetime Income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Each year, hundreds of thousands of Americans die from heart disease. It's America's number one killer. It's estimated that direct and indirect cost of heart disease total more than $320 billion. The standard protocol to cure heart disease has been either surgery or statin drugs. But there are other means of curing the disease and making a person healthy. Joining us on the program is Dr. Drew Collins. And Doctor, I want to talk about something that I read, probably 10, 15 years ago, I was subscribing to a newsletter on Dow theory, and Richard Russell, who's well known in the investment community, talked about his own troubles with heart disease. He had bypass surgery, several heart attacks. In his last heart attack, he was basically told to, you know, go see his estate planning attorney, and he discovered a doctor in your practice, chelation therapy. Today, Richard is close to 90 years old. So, first of all, I wonder if you can tell us, what is chelation therapy for our listeners who may not be aware of it?
We want to tell everybody about the options of chelation therapy because we see a lot of benefits. In the world, over the last, say, 50 to 60 years, the governments that use lead paint, like in the Navy, people that do exposure to heavy metals and that sort of thing, they've noticed that people get poisoned by things like lead and other heavy metals. So EDTA is a compound that chelates or grabs positively charged heavy metal ions. So the word chelation comes from grabbing or taking or chelating, and the process of detoxing or removing those poisonous metals from the body has been around for a long time, most notably by the Navy and people putting on lead paint on battleships and stuff. So what you were talking about earlier was the idea of doing it therapeutically for people with heart disease and other circulatory problems. And we're in a clinic here that's been around for 30 years that has seen tremendous results with an outpatient procedure known as chelation therapy, where people come in and over a period of 2 to 3 hours get an infusion of not just EDTA, which is a molecule, but also other nutrients like B vitamins and magnesium and heart-healthy nutrients like taurine and that sort of thing. So chelation therapy is usually thought of for people with atherosclerosis, which is fatty thickening of the arteries, but it's also very good for people who are diabetic that have microcirculation problems. And what we see is people come in, you have either heard, like you have anecdotally from a friend, or they've read something on the internet or books are out there about heart disease being helped, or they have a symptom like a chest pain or something, and they usually get scared and they want to look into options. So when people come to us, we go through a cardiovascular workup, and we often work in conjunction with their cardiologist, and we have avail to them the stress test or EKGs or echocardiograms and different ways to find out what their blood flow is through their heart and through their carotid arteries. So we give them a workup with routine lab tests, but also specific things for their circulation, and we deem them candidates for the treatment. It's like, as I said, it's an outpatient practice where people come to our office and they leave happy. They don't have to change their routine at all. And chelation therapy is done all over the world, and usually a certain type of doctor will do it. They have to go through special training. They're usually believers in this sort of thing, and they go to national conferences and national certification and get up to speed. And people who look for chelation can go online and look to ACAM, which is the governing body. And what we're finding is that over the last 30 years or so, the results continue to be positive, but how we think it's working is changing a little bit. So at one point, we thought it was all about roto-rootering out the pipes. And I think even the people like Richard Russell might have thought that that was what was going on. But now we talk more about inflammation. And inflammation is the root of most disease, chronic diseases in our Western society. So if you're looking to reduce inflammation, chelation is a good tool for that. So we talk about things like metabolic cardiology, which is basically nutritional treatment for heart disease, and by inference, diabetes also. So people come in and we give them a whole program.
So, doctor, you know, originally it was discovered as a means of taking out, let's say, toxic chemicals out of the body. Is there a relationship directly with toxic chemicals in the body and heart disease or the deterioration of the circulatory system in the body?
Yes. The way that heavy metals cause heart disease is that they get established in the intima, or the lining of the arteries and vessels, and they cause inflammation. And the inflammation then sets up this cascade of events that ends up leading to what they call plaque, which is the stuff that plugs the arteries. So if you can get rid of the heavy metals, then you can reduce the inflammation. And there's other factors, but this is one of the things that you have to take into account when someone has advanced cardiovascular disease and even things like diabetes. You have to get the heavy metals out. Virtually everybody in our Western society has heavy metal exposure, from paint and cars and industrial waste and that sort of thing. So especially if you're in a livelihood like welding or farming or around solvents and that kind of thing. So we do a test for people, which is a provoked response. We give people an IV drip of EDTA, and then they collect their urine for 12 hours, and we send it to a lab that flames it in a spectrophotometer and reads the different metals that are in that urine sample, and then we give them a protocol based on what different types of heavy load they have of their heavy metals, and that's including things like mercury and antimony and tungsten and lead and cadmium and these things that shouldn't be in our bodies, but they are. So we really haven't found anybody that doesn't have them in their body, and the older you are, the more you have. So you can make yourself crazy thinking about the unseen killer inside you, but the good news is that EDTA very effectively gets it out of you, and a little bit of EDTA gets a pretty good amount of it out, and you can pause and come back later and do a little more later, and it comes out faster than you're going in. So people who start a program of detoxing their heavy metal out of them can get caught up and actually reduce their risk of inflammatory heart disease or even advanced neurological problems like Alzheimer's and dementia and that sort of thing. So not only just heart disease, but also for the advanced neurological problems.
You know, doctor, you bring up something that we're seeing more and more studies being done on, especially with autoimmune disease, where it talks about so much of the diseases in the body come from the gut with inflammation. And you just pointed out that with chelation therapy, you're finding more and more today that the reason it works so well is it reduces inflammation in the body. Can you talk about that for a minute and the causes of inflammation and the direct, let's say, results of, let's say, things like autoimmune disease or other diseases from heart disease to diabetes?
Right. So inflammation is not just our bailiwick. It's most doctors are trying to lower inflammation, and you've heard of statins, and that's one of the reasons why people are promoting statins, because they have a secondary effect of lowering C-reactive protein and other things that are markers for inflammation that we talked about at an earlier radio show. But the biggest picture for most people with inflammation is the presence of circulating sugar, and that tends to make people have inflammatory problems all throughout their body. But for the purpose of chelation, heavy metals are chelated out by that one EDTA, but getting intravenous therapy and that cardiovascular metabolic protocol and nutritional treatment in general will help people with inflammation based on excess blood sugar. So inflammation can happen from excess blood sugar that can lead to a diabetic problem, but also it can happen from toxicity of industrial metals and environmentally exposed poisons. And of course, stress can cause it just neurologically. You can make a lot of cortisol and different things that are released that break down your body just from wear and tear of your own physiology. But the big ones are sugar, so you want to get your circulating blood sugar down, and heavy metals, if you can get to somebody that knows how to chelate. They even make oral chelation, which doesn't work that well, but it's better than nothing. And people talk about different products that do that. Your diet can do that. Fiber does it. Things like chlorella do it. And even garlic has been known to chelate. But the big one, industrial strength one, is EDTA, which is a molecule that's actually in frozen peas and different things. It's an antioxidant. So it's in our nutritional intake anyway. It's sort of something that we stumble across without knowing it. So it's in our culture already.
Doctor, when you start to chelate an individual, not only are you removing, let's say, the industrial toxins and things that we're exposed to from either exposure to things in our environment, but also over a long period of time, because we've heard things like reversing heart disease, that if people change their diets, eventually they can clean out their arteries. A good example is what we've seen with President Bill Clinton, who had not only bypass surgery, but a year later a stent, and then now he's gone the route of changing his diet. Does chelation clean out the arteries eventually through successive treatment? Or is that in combination with a diet? For example, you hear either vegetarian diets or things like the paleo diet that reduce inflammation, sugars, and other harmful effects of the body are also part of the cure.
Yeah, well, what you just said, I agree with. So you have to have lifestyle and nutritional changes. But to the point of what chelation actually does, we used to promise people that it was roto-rootering out their coronary arteries. And I think when the coronary calcium scores came out, they had CAT scan machines that were looking at the hard mineralization of these arteries. They realized that people who had a lot of chelation treatments, even though they were feeling better and their circulation was better, the places that they had these pathological accumulations weren't changing. So they're not claiming that it roto-rooters out the arteries anymore. They're claiming that it increases collateral circulation. So imagine a freeway that gets plugged up and the side roads or the alternate routes get encouraged to widen and carry the load of the traffic. And that's what the new model is. Instead of it being literally the plugged part gets reamed out, it's more that the encouragement of circulation goes around that pathology. So you get what you want. Ultimately, you get the blood supply to the heart muscle. And even like for a diabetic, the microcirculation gets increased. But the places that are plugged tend to stay plugged. And what a stent does is a stent really forces open an area that's already got some pathology in it. But the problem remains that that vessel is compromised. And so usually within about 6 months, they replug. So no one's really addressed that. And what's nice about chelation is even if someone has stents, it'll still help them because it does encourage the collateral circulation. So you see it on a test called an angiogram where there's blood flow in real time. And you can see the blood going around these places that are plugged. And people don't have the chest pains, the angina, the uncomfortable feeling with exercise, whatever they used to have. So people feel better and there's more blood flow. But the old time version of saying that the Roto-Rooter's out or cleans out the plugged pipe, I think that's an old model that's been proven wrong.
Doctor, I know that chelation is used in your practice and it's been very effective in terms of helping people with potential cardiac problems. Why is it not as widely used? I mean, when you think of heart disease today, you think of two answers, either surgery or you think of some kind of statin drug. And of course, some modification of diet, you know, whether it's reduction of salt, reducing fatty foods. Why do you think it's not as well known in the industry?
I think what doctors get taught in medical school is what they do in practice. And when doctors go to conferences, they go to conferences that promote the new techniques. And so they got to keep up with their professional careers based on what their peers or their particular place of practice is encouraging. And a lot of that's driven by recently catheterization and stent technology and these procedures. So something like chelation, which is a fairly low-tech, benign practice, it's not as revenue-intense. It's also been, up until recently, been poorly supported by literature. So even though there's hundreds of thousands of anecdotal cases and people have received chelation therapy for years, when you're a cardiologist or when you're a hospital and you want to base what you do on research and data, usually that data is only studies that are funded by pharmaceutical companies or by procedure type medical devices, and the latest wave is about stent technology and catheterization. So that's really become a revenue-generating center for these hospitals and these clinics, and they do a lot of work with immediate relief of those people's heart pain, and so they don't have time to talk about Plan B because they go in and they have a really good procedure, and they come out and they have very little downtime. And it's not like when they had open-heart surgery and people were down for a long time. But I just want to note that there was a 2012 National Institute of Health 10-year trial on chelation that was reported. And basically, the results were statistically significant that people who did IV chelation were less likely to die of heart disease. And yet, after that came out, and it was a very rigorous study with about 1,700 patients over 10 years, the results was that people thought it was going to be something that was going to raise some questions but not change practice. So even though there's evidence, it doesn't necessarily change the momentum of cardiology. What's probably more likely to change cardiology is what the patients are asking their doctors for, and even things like the internet and TV doctors like Dr. Oz. People talk about things like CoQ10. So the public is demanding options for metabolic cardiology, and that's going to become something that the doctors have to answer to. So when it comes to procedures like stents, those are still going to be around because they work, and they may plug up in 6 months, but they make a lot of money for the hospitals and people get relief. So you're not going to see that go away anytime soon. There are going to just be more and more advances in the technology of those stents. So people like them, and they're not going to shy away from that as an option. But when it comes to chelation, it doesn't really have any promoters or any backers that are influential. It's more like low-tech clinics that are scattered throughout the country or the continents. And people kind of seek it out because they've heard about it like you did. And it's available, and it's legal, and people get the results, and it's safe. But as far as it being offered in big hospital systems, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like it's got people's attention.
I know when you use chelation therapy, let's say you're treating somebody with a potential cardio problem or the beginning signs of heart disease, or they may already have it. I know that diet is a key point, and, you know, so little is spent on diet. I know that you have looked at various diets from vegans to vegetarians to pescatarians to paleo. Can you address the paleo diet? Because it's been proven to be very effective in reducing inflammation. I wonder if you might address that next.
Yeah, I think everybody's a little different, so you have to kind of take people one-on-one. But in general, I think the biggest wave of disease is the diabetic crisis that's happening in all countries, in India and China and Mexico and the United States, and the kids are getting diabetic and obese at early ages. And that's apparently because they're not able to handle the grain-based carbohydrate and even the simple sugars and what's going on in our diet. So when you say paleo diet, the first thing the paleo diet's about is like Paleolithic Stone Age man didn't have time to hang around and make grain. So they take grain out of the diet. And if you remove grain from a diet, even though a little grain is not going to hurt you, what it substantially does is it makes you have to eat more fat, and we like fat, and it's going to make you eat more green vegetables and more fiber, which we like, and it's going to lower that reactive insulin response. So the biggest health thing you can do for your diet is to get your sugar level to drop down and be stable, which the paleo diet does pretty quickly. So not everybody likes it because they don't understand how to do it right, and they don't do enough fiber. They can usually get behind the meat idea, you know, that's the caveman thing, but paleo diet includes a lot of greens and a lot of fiber too, and it doesn't do very much with the grain. So that, over the years for me, that seems to work for me the best, and without a whole lot of effort, I can keep my body stable. And our patients, we go back and forth. The biggest argument with people tends to be the grains and the carbohydrates. And when it comes to fat, there's a great book out by Nina Techholz, New York Times bestseller, called The Big Fat Surprise. And she goes back to all the different nutritional research in the last 40, 50 years and realizes that we've kind of given fat a bad name. So everything's been fat-free and low-fat and that kind of thing. And the nice thing about the paleo diet is it sort of reintroduces butter and coconut oil and animal fat and the idea that some saturated fat's important. So that helps you stabilize your craving for starch and for sugar. It came up kind of with the Dr. Atkins diet a little bit, but I think he failed in some of the aspects of the fiber and the green part, but the paleo diet has been promoted by a lot of the CrossFit people and healthy young athletes, and if they get it right, they can get their body pretty lean and some dramatic reversals of cardiovascular disease and different problems just by diet like you're talking about. So when you say paleo, what you're referring to for your listeners is a very low grain and carbohydrate diet that is encouraging protein and fiber and high nutritionally dense vegetables. And that's different than what we're used to. We're used to doing, you know, a lot of deep fat fried food and plant-based rancid oils and a lot of quick sugars, and we're making everybody diabetic. So that's the problem.
Doctor, in terms of normal keeping up with health, individuals know that once a year you go to see your doctor, you get an annual physical. But a lot of the things that you just talked about, whether it's inflammation in the body or it's toxic chemicals in the system, those kind of tests or being aware of those kind of things in the body isn't standard protocol for an annual physical. So for our listeners, if they wanted to find if they have, for example, a high degree of toxic chemicals in the body and a lot of inflammation, what kind of tests are out there that an individual should maybe request from the doctor, and is it covered under most insurance?
The answer is no, it's not covered by most insurance unless a doctor or specialist asks for it pretty please, and they have to believe that it's important. So cost containment for most models in insurance coverage is that the doctor doesn't want to do tests unless they absolutely have to. And that kind of goes against doctors' inclination because we are big heroes if we find something, and testing is a way of moving the conversation down the line. But most doctors now are being monitored economically so that they don't utilize testing. And so you'll find that even the one we've talked about before, the hemoglobin A1C, which is a great marker for blood sugar, isn't the first go-to number they look for. So you have to kind of ask for that. Most doctors realize that's important, but it's not the first round of once-a-year tests. And that's easy enough to ask for. And I think I mentioned this before, but the lifeextension.com is a vitamin company, but they also have lab tests that are the cutting edge. And you can go online and ask for them to give you a requisition, and you go to LabCorp, a different blood draw station, and get these panels that are really excellent, having to do with all the things we talked about, except for the degree of heavy metal toxicity, but that's another level of testing. But for what you're asking about, you can get access now through the internet, lab tests that answer these questions. And if your doctors won't do it, then you can go online and ask for these panels, pay for them yourself. It's outside of the insurance. And then you have to find somebody to interpret that for you. But that's easier to do than to get the test. So it's available now, and people are going around the conventional system and asking for things that they found out about to find out how they're doing in their biological age and their chronological age. So, hemoglobin A1C, of course, is the blood test thing we talked about for the sugar. And C-reactive protein is my favorite go-to thing for inflammation. And if you want to do heavy metal testing, then you want to work with somebody that does, in my opinion, an EDTA-provoked challenge and find out what heavy metals are in you. There's other ways to do it, but a serum test for heavy metals doesn't really show it because the body sequesters it. So you have to provoke the body. You have to go and grab it out of the bone and different things. Like, we've had lab tests from insurance companies that say, well, this person doesn't have heavy metals because we did a blood test and they didn't have any lead. Well, if they had lead in their blood, they'd be so poisoned, they'll almost be dead. So you have to look at it a different way than just conventional serum levels of heavy metals. So that's another level of specialty that chelation top doctors, or a lot of doctors, will do if you ask them. Say, hey, I want to check for heavy metals. They can do that for you. But the doctors that are the typical insurance doctors, that's kind of above the level of screening that they do once a year. And they have to feel like there's a reason. So the problem is that those doctors don't necessarily feel like there's a reason for it. And you might have to nudge them a little bit.
Well, Doctor, listen, as we close, how can our listeners find out more information about the work that you do and also about chelation therapy and the things we discussed in this interview?
Right. So the American College for the Advancement in Medicine, ACAM, American College for the Advancement in Medicine, is the go-to place for finding out about chelation. And they have ways to find out doctors in your area. So ACAM, A-C-A-M. And then for me personally, SanDiegoHealthClinic.com is our website. And we're down here in San Diego making the moonshine. So have people call us if they want. We can direct them in their area to somebody, or we can help them here.
Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Always great to hear from you, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
Once again, heart disease is number one killer in the U.S., and so much of this can be prevented by being proactive, as the doctor talked about, finding out about diets, finding out about your own situation, the tests that are out there today. So there's a lot that can be done, but once again, it's going to depend on you. And the ultimate thing, you're in charge of your own health. Nobody else is. Why not be healthy? If you're saving for retirement, why not enjoy it with a healthy lifestyle? Well, that concludes this week's program. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.